Welcome to Catch a Mac Science. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. Once a month on Saturday from 11 a.m. to noon, Catch a Mac Science will provide a platform for discussion, inquiry, and peer review of local science. On this episode of Catch a Mac Science, highlights from the 2018 Alaska Invasive Species Workshop, put on by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service, and SNPM, or what was formerly known as SNPM, the Committee for Noxious and Invasive Pests Management. At the end of the Invasive Species Workshop, they chose a new name, the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership. The workshop drew presenters and attendees from all over Alaska and all over the country. In fact, Catch a Mac Science will spend the next two episodes bringing you recordings from this workshop, held November 13th through the 15th. Later in the program, you'll hear Shauna Batista from the U.S. Forest Service in conversation with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies' Seth Spencer about the eradication of hawkweed. And you'll hear from keynote speaker Matthew Barnes from Texas Tech University on invasivorism as a tool for managing invasive species. Chris Rainwater from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District was the closer on Thursday afternoon. But we're going to start with Chris. He positions himself a few times in time and space, so you should know that he's speaking from the quarterdeck at Land's End, and there is a variety of local invasive plants artfully arranged on his lectern.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Rainwater, born in the territory of Alaska and raised right here. I was actually born in Seldovia, the first known spot in the Cook Inlet to receive dandelions. But we think it started with the first modern white people to show up, and that would be the Russians. They may have brought orange hawkweed. There's a little spot in Little Salmon Creek on Kodiak where hawkweed was identified, and they fell in on it, and we had a weed person here, and we had orange hawkweed, and he did a DNA comparison and discovered that the hawkweed from Kodiak was significantly different than the one we had. And so it leads us to think that perhaps in the chronology of these weeds, the Russians might have been first. It's true that these weeds didn't come over the Bering Land Bridge with indigenous peoples. They depend on large transportation and quick transportation to get a seed from here to there before it loses its germination, to get a plant tissue from here to there before it loses its viability. These invasives start and continue with modern transportation, and we know what's going on with that. It's getting bigger and quicker all the time. That's what, of course, I think worries all of us, because these vectors are getting stronger. So continuing the human footprint, the next big invasion was the gold seekers in Alaska, and they showed up with these horses and mules, and all over the early footprint of Alaska, you find piles of mule shoes and piles of draft horse shoes, and in this one of these cases, they're wearing snowshoes because winter travel was easier, but everywhere they came, they brought the dandelion, and they probably brought the chickweed, the foodstuffs and things that were clinging to their feet when they left Seattle. And so the mining towns and the little bitty mines that had these draft horses almost always have dandelions. And from there, you know, they got spread into the little communities that came later, and we all had dandelions in our yards and creeping into our hay fields. My father, when he showed up in 1951, I staked a couple of homesteads way up on the hill out here, ran the beach, cut a trail up the bluff to access it for tractors, and watched the dandelion creep one switchback at a time, one year at a time, until it was in our hayfields. And it was one of those things, though, that we could tolerate. It's a single invasive. You had to put your haying off until the 10th of July, because otherwise the bloom from this dandelion is just perfect to plug your radiator, you're overheating your tractors, you're shutting down to blow down the dandelion dust. And it was fairly easy to deal with just one of these. But the rest of them that are coming are very worrisome. Chickweed, of course, is not an invader into perennial grasslands. It's always around the edges, but it showed up at the same time as dandelions. Logging is also people going into places that they've never been. Southeast, of course, had the big logging projects with cables and steam winches, and later on, after the war, you know, came high-lead logging and helicopter logging. They also bring weeds with them. And, of course, they open the ground to, you know, seed beds for invasives. They don't have much impact on our hay fields until we came to the spruce bark beetle. Then we had a salvage logging operation here that was almost everywhere. There was millions of tons of product came out of right here behind us. We shipped chipped spruce trees by the major cargo vessels coming in here all the time, making paper out of them. Round logs, of course, went as well. But in the meantime, all of these chip trailers and trucks came in from Idaho and the Cascades to haul our chips for us, and things fell off of them that jump into the gravels and start creeping around. These are just vectors, and they're the forces, though, that bring these new vectors, and they open new ground, and we can expect more of them. So it brings us to the early days of Alaska. We buy it from Russia. We have gold rushes. We start the University of Alaska School of Mines and Agriculture, and they brought in many things, you know, to help us out. Lots of it in parallel with the colony at Palmer. I've got bird vetch and reed canary grass as two of them that they were brought in to plant for. This bothers me, these invasive weeds right here on my podium. I normally have a special place for those, and I chop them up and pour diesel on them. I couldn't tolerate it anymore. With hay fields, we understand that you let one little snip of these things get started in one little corner, and soon they will own your whole field. And the mobility of this haying machinery, you know, is marvelous. We can hit one lever and hike that thing up and grab a gear and be 10 miles away, you know, in 30 minutes. And before the seeds blow off of your baler, you're over baling your neighbor's hay because he's called you to do this. He doesn't understand, and you don't understand, that you have just transported yellow hawkweed from one big watershed to the next. We certainly see that these hayfield weeds get transported not only in their product, but in the machinery that does it. And it's hard to blow the seeds off a round baler. They make equipment that'll do it, but nobody has it available. We've thought about providing it at our conservation district, a high pressure washer. But then you got to set up a spot, and what do you do with the seeds that are blown off? And if anybody's got good ideas along that area, we are wide open to working on it. The other one that I've got identified is hemp nettle, and that's a kind of a tragic little piece in the story, you know, of our own place, because I think the first hemp nettle jumped off at our ranch. There was a batch of draft dodgers showed up from Idaho with a little bitty stock truck, and we were at the end of the road. If you left Idaho and kept driving, taking a left nor a right, you would end up in our yard, and that's where they were. And can we drop this gate and let these horses out? And they did, and then shoveled the duff from the bottom. And there, right next to our sawmill, jumped up this exotic weed. And we walked around, you know, and looked at it, wonder what that is. And we could have, with a single spray bottle, held hemp nettle back for 20 years, but we didn't realize, you know, what it was going to do. But it just loves disturbed ground, and it just loves feedlots. And very shortly, you know, we found it in our feedlot. And, of course, we're taking our horses to the rodeo, and we're sending in, so there's all kind of vectors where those big oil seeds, I'm sure some of you are familiar with hemp nettle, but it has got some oil seeds. It, incidentally, I think I will give it credit for allowing pheasants now to live in the Kachemak. They had nothing like that before, but I noticed that in my hay fields and my feedlots in the springtime, I don't know where these pheasants actually winter, but in the springtime, those roosters will come sailing in and I push my cow manure up and compost it. And so always in the springtime, on the sunny side, that's the first place that will thaw. And them roosters know about it. And they'll dig those oil seeds out and make it through the winter. The hemp nettle is actually not an economic problem for hay growers because it, again, can't compete with perennial grasslands. And it's waiting for any time you break ground. And it loves tramping around on dozers. I've noticed HEA's got a power line comes out of the Brady Lake Project 40 miles away. And in the tracks of the dozers, they have to go up and do routine maintenance. In the tracks of the dozers, there are hemp nettles growing there. And those things, they can go a long ways in the course of one season because they're so enduring. Those oil seeds will wait there until something mashes them in and they'll jump up. But they're not that big of an economic threat. Bird vetch. Man, I don't know how we managed to avoid bird vetch for 50 years, but it has been hanging around the colony. And now you can see it running the fences into Anchorage and owning vast swaths of that. I'm very irate because bird vetch jumped out of the Islands and Oceans Visitor Center, crossed the Sterling Highway, and is crawling up into this little fringe of trees, into a little piece of wilderness in Homer. And we know that if you spray something on that bird vetch that will kill it, it'll probably also kill those trees. And so we're hung. We don't own the land. We don't have a deal with DOT with their right-of-ways. I don't like talking about dysfunctional things, but that's one of them. Reed canary grass. It's one that showed up in Homer, you might say in the early days, because we had an old botanist here that was fascinated by plants of the world and was collaborating with the University of Alaska, and he was always bringing things down and putting in his little botanical garden. He happened to live in one of the major floodplains out here, and from time to time, we get mudslides. As he entered into his golden years, his eyesight started failing, and you know, I think he failed to notice that his reed canary grass was creeping out of his driveway. And when it got into the ditch line, then these mudslides that visit us from time to time happen. And of course, everybody shows up now with a big smooth mouth backhoe and they're loading that mud out and they're throwing it in end dumps and they're hauling it away and they're throwing it down somewhere else. And along with it goes the reed canary grass. It's one of the biggest problems we've got is DOT cleaning their ditches, throwing that material in side dumps and end dumps, trying to keep track of the invasive weeds in our ditches and try to keep it from showing up, you know, in our own little turf. It's a full-time job, and we don't have anybody assigned to that. We had Canadian thistle probably brought in here in the late 90s. We didn't know about it, of course, until, you know, 6 years later when it was well established in one little spot. But it most certainly came in on Canadian hay. There was an old boy that was bringing hay in and having a great time and selling it hither and thither. And in one little spot where there was a feed store, roadside feed store, and a little feedlot, we end up with this Canadian thistle. And man, we threw some resources at that, trying out all kinds of exotic killers. And of course, there was a wet spot that required special broadleaf killers and pulling it. And the landowner fell in on the night shift with a dozer and thought he'd help us out and swept the whole turf and everything over and threw it in the creek, which of course does not work at all now. It's all down in there where you can't use normal and effective pesticides. But we thought we had it whipped until this summer, and here comes four little sprouts that must have had a rhizome down there that survived. We also know that this stuff doesn't spread well by seed that's produced here. The original seed that came in maybe on the hay from Canada was viable. If this stuff had viable seed, it would own this whole Homer bench, and it doesn't. Even though it's horribly invasive when it gets spotted, it seems that the seed that it produces here is not that viable, and if you can outrun its rhizomes, you've got a pretty good chance. We have tried to figure out how many genetic variations are disguised in this single bloom phase here, but we've come to call it fall dandelion. And it is ugly because its seed is viable and it travels around in hay bales and on hay and equipment and on ATVs and bottoms of horses' feet and all kinds of things. I had a place on my ranch that I let people bring their equipment in and park it and jump their horses out and jump their wheelers out, and I discover that it's a great little incubator for all kinds of invasives and yellow hawkweed and orange hawkweed, and I haven't had any Canadian thistle. These came in this last surge of invasives. We don't know how many more there are. I threw in at the last minute a source from this Canadian hay is this rat-tailed mouse. I was alarmed. It was 5 years ago, and we had this discussion going in our conservation district, and one of the people was saying that they had this house mouse, and I said, what was it? We got two kinds. I said, was it a red-back vole, or was it a shrew? No, it's a mouse. It's big ears and rat tail. No, we don't have those. And she was right, and I was wrong. They jumped out of, again, maybe this same fellow that brought the Canadian thistle also brought this rat-tailed mouse. But later on, my neighbor went off to Delta and come back with some super bales, the 4x8s, and he was feeding them to his mules, and I noticed that they had boreholes in them, in little cavity nests. And I didn't realize how recently abandoned those cavity nests were, because in the next 18 months, then we have this rat-tailed mouse. One of the stories is that he's the same one that came across with Marco Polo over the Silk Road in the 1200s and spread his way through Europe and made its way to Canada recently and now swept the grain states of Canada and now in our yards. But they're a vicious little rascal. They have got a jaw structure on them that you would think would come on a walrus or an alligator. And they've got these teeth that bore right through the side of your house. And they've also got cat claws on them. They can run right up the face of your cabinets and be up there eating your butter when you wake up in the morning. The good thing is that they have actually a natural check. The weasel will come and thin them way back. These little rascals are also hitching rides on hay trucks, and they're showing up in our hay fields. Orange hawkweed, off we go. The innocent and well-intentioned. They have led significantly to the spread of this little orange hawkweed. They're such a beautiful little plant that people can't help themselves. They reach down there and they steal one from upstate and put it in their Winnebago and come back and plant it and give it to their relatives. Didn't realize, you know, that it wouldn't stay where you put it. This vector is real, the innocent and well-intentioned. My folks couldn't help themselves coming through Canada. They stopped and picked up 6 or 8 little bitty pine trees and brought them home. Now, that's not a problem. It doesn't make the list, but it's that gathering instinct of people to take things with them. And plants from the old country, they got to bring them to the new country. It's almost like when we talk about water pollution and you got point pollution and non-point pollution, and you have these methods that these things are tracked around. You can't actually identify who it was, but we know that there, you know, all the traffic that comes up our roads have muds and dusts clinging to them. And they got dogs in there with thistles stuck in their hide, and they will jump out. Lots of times we can't point to a single vector and a single guilty person that brings these things. They just show up, build it, and they will come. I'm speaking about roads. And so this tall buttercup is the latest one, the last one that I can point to that has now visited Homer. And first we see it in the little gardens of the Homer roadside, little bitty boxes and a little tall buttercup living there. Man, it is capable of covering some ground. And I didn't even know until like last year that it's also poisonous to livestock. And I don't even know if that's in early stages or late stages, but Flickinger had a story from Kodiak. He said the tall buttercup showed up with the missile launch. His cattle ranch is right down there next to the missile launch. And they had to improve the road, and then they brought these missiles in and all of their launchers from who knows where, but He said the Tall Buttercup followed the missile launch. And so now they've got it down there, and he said there was a bison die-off down there that he was attributing to them not knowing that this thing was poisonous. It might be, bison are pretty smart. It might be that the survivors will teach their progeny, don't bite the yellow buttercup, it might kill you. The first exposure of domestic animals to that means that the dumb ones are going to die. There's nothing that has shown up as an invasive except this bird cherry. I think I personally have close to $10,000 in economic losses from that bird cherry. The most expensive herd bull and the best one I ever had had bird cherry leaves blown over a picket fence, and he was grazing along in the springtime to get the early grass, and probably got a bunch of those winter cured bird cherry leaves. At any rate, I didn't know that the bird cherry was going to be toxic until they started talking about the moose. The moose in Anchorage dying from these things in foamy mouth. It's not that hard. I had a wood chopper down there wanting to cut firewood off my place, and I said, okay, you can do it, but you got to kill the bird cherry tree. And he put his chainsaw to it and cut that thing down, hauled it off. But it all went to suckers. There is a whole bunch of bird cherry suckers there now. And so I've got to go in with some kind of a nuclear option. As I say, it's a clear and present danger. Anything that eats that thing's fixing to die. Other things that actually contribute or have contributed are these emergencies. The first one that I can point to was the 1964 earthquake. We sank 6 feet here in 6 minutes. And there was no TV, but the radio was all about people dying and tidal waves. And so we couldn't see the bay from our earliest homestead cabin, but we all went down that next evening to look out on the bay and see if we could find a tidal wave. And sure as hell, the ocean came in around the cottonwood trees, and it's up in places where it had never been. But just like the Japanese in Fukushima, we weren't seeing a tidal wave. We were seeing a subsided land, and the tide is telling us where the next tide line is going to be. All of those cottonwood trees died. Everything moved back 6 vertical feet. But in the middle of that, we ended up with a federal disaster grain. In Kodiak, the tidal wave had washed away some of their haystacks that had been down next to the intertidal zone. We were on the supply chain for this grain going to Kodiak, and the local ranchers were given the option of using this. For it was $1 a bag or something. It was very cheap. It wasn't free, but it was very cheap. It was the coldest spring in the history of modern history of Alaska, that spring of 64, and so the grass didn't grow. And we used this grain, and we put it on pack mules and pack horses, took it down off of our switchback and up to where the cows were waiting for the grass to grow. It had this squirrel tail barley seed. Doesn't take much when you've got a couple of 3 tons of this stuff and you're taking it out across the landscape and feeding your cows. Turns out when you Google up squirrel-tailed barley, there's about 12 options there. It has taken 50 years for it to occupy 5% of my hay ground. In 2002, we had 2 or maybe 3 100-year event floods right here. Again, the hillside blows, big wads of mud down onto this lower slope, and the excavators and the side dumps all show up from all corners of the world. And they're hauling this mud off, and they're bringing riprap in from Girdwood, they're bringing it in from Seward, they're bringing in from anybody that's got shot rock to armor up the culverts and reestablish the creeks where they belong. And with those come these other invasives that will fall off of those. And they fall into the perfect environment, muddy flood zones, wherever you end up digging and dumping in these big flood events, you create this place to get started. We can expect there'll be some more of those floods. But we have been flood-free since 2002, and it's remarkable. It's now been 15, 16 years since we've had a significant mudslide event. I don't think that they are done. Kachemak Bay is named that because it's in one of the indigenous languages. It means Smoky Bay. because the coal veins were burning, and those would jump out from time to time and burn off this bench. And the bench was grassy, and the hillside was only brushy. There was no large timber on the hillside. I have seen it even in my own life change from a rose bush face to a largely cottonwood-dominated face. And maybe that's going to give some stability to those faces, but I think what it's going to do is actually make it just worse when it comes down. Another piece of this puzzle, of course, is exotic grasses. Homeowners using all kinds of grasses that they pick up from here and there. Way off in Dogfish Bay, they had a helicopter logging project. And after the 2002 floods, I found myself down there putting their creeks back in their culverts and their culverts back in their creeks. And we found a string of grass down there that had been brought in by the logging. And I don't know what it was. I'm afraid it was quack grass. But way out there in a pristine place where the only way it could have got there is to fall off of a piece of logging equipment. There's no vectors that will bring it here. But it's too far for us to reach out there and swat. It'd take $2,500 to mob a crew out there for a project that not yet has become economically significant. It brings us to this, you know, end. How can we set ourselves up to deal with what's coming? We have been reactionary. We have been seeing that, oh, what is this? And it takes us a year or so to identify it, and it takes us a year or so to figure out, you know, what it's susceptible to. And by the time we have figured that and our concentration has been diverted, there's one coming up behind us. And we're not done with finding new invasive weeds in our agricultural land and even in our parks and recreation ground. That's why we're here, to learn from one another, to share our stories and try to prepare for what's coming.
Chris Rainwater from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District Board of Directors and his presentation, The History of Invasives in Homer Hayfields. That hawkweed he mentioned got its own spot on the agenda. On Wednesday, Shauna Batista from the U.S. Forest Service presented on Hawkweeds in the Pacific Northwest, Impacts, Successes, and Challenges. You'll be able to hear that in its entirety on the Kachemak Science page at kbbi.org. After her presentation at the workshop, Batista sat down with Seth Spencer, the Education Coordinator for the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies and the Wind Nature Center, to talk about hawkweed in Homer.
I find it really interesting that Oregon and Washington seem to be dealing with some of the same issues that Homer and kind of south central, southeast Alaska are as well, with this, we specifically orange hawkweed, but also a bit of the yellow hawkweed moving on in, and how to tackle it, whether it's worth tackling it, and then how to get people to be aware or care. Because just today, somebody told me they were looking at some wonderful tourism pictures of Alaska showing these majestic landscapes, and all of a sudden there was a field full of hawkweed, and that was main tourism pictures showing an invasive species. So I guess I'd be curious to kind of find out maybe a little bit more about orange hawkweed, why it's such a problem, and possibly some things that Alaska, specifically Homer, might be able to do.
It is definitely worth going after, and early detection, rapid response is absolutely the key. Get it while it's small. Chances of success are far greater. One of the messages I always like to try to educate the public about is our actions, our management, are not just about dead weeds. We have to take a step back and look at why. Why are we doing this? Not just because it's some bias against non-natives. It's because the more research that is done on the ecological effects of non-native plants, the more we are finding that they actually have sometimes profound ecosystem consequences. It can change nutrient cycling. It can change soil properties. It can harm native pollinators. It can reduce the seed set of our native plants. I mentioned my concern about showy flowers like orange and yellow hawkweed attracting pollinators away from native berry plants, that the production of the food berries is crucially linked to the pollinators. I think we always have to communicate first, why do we want to do this? And then two, what will work? What are some things that we can put into practice to help? You're not alone seeing those tourism photos full of invasive plants. That is one of my pet peeves. I go to marketing companies to create these brochures and they don't know native from invasive. They just want showy. And so that happens a lot more frequently than we would like. So a lot of education and thinking about educating diverse publics and businesses, not just landowners or people who like to go hiking, but tour guides and all of that. We have to think very broadly about our education campaigns.
And I think that's really interesting what you kind of mentioned, is just how it might be affecting really important things here in Homer, such as our blueberries, or that it seems to be spreading. I just looked at a map this morning. It's definitely on the Kenai Peninsula, Kodiak, Southeast Alaska, but is working its way up the Alaskan Peninsula. And I've just noticed in the 4 years that I've been here in Homer that it's working its way up East Skyline, down East End Road. And it does, the main issue that I'm noticing is it kind of, once it's there, and you mentioned this in a talk today, that you have to go back year after year. You think you've got it. You've dug everything up. You might have used some herbicide, but you got to go back year one, two, and three to really make sure, because maybe you can speak a little bit to why it's really hard to get rid of hawkweed. I heard that maybe it takes 7 years for anything in the soil to die.
The seed viability has been measured for hawkweed to last 7 years. So that is a challenge, and those seeds can just hang out waiting for just the right opportunity to germinate. In addition, hawkweed has extensive rhizomatous roots underground and stolons above ground, so it can spread vegetatively. So if you dig it up but you miss part of the roots, eventually those roots are going to resprout and form a new plant. One of the challenges of really effectively eradicating spots of hawkweed is maybe 2 or 3 years after your initial control efforts, lots of native plants have moved back in, you have lots of grass, lots of other plants, but then that sneaky little rosette pops up and it's hard to find, it's hard to see, and so it might spread vegetatively around there for a few years and then boom, you've got a patch back again. People often underestimate the amount of time and effort it takes to do that real hard searching for those last few plants.
And I think that's something that I am learning. Working on the Wind Nature Center property, 150 acres, it did surprise me at how much effort, but the more I learn about it, it is worth the effort. And what's helpful is that people around the Homer community, a lot of personal landowners, are also very aware of the issue that hawkweed could present and are very active in trying to reduce it, not have it spread, and are very vocal, which is good, to make sure that it's not spreading down kind of away from the roadsides, because I know that can be a main an issue in the ditches, but I'm always surprised where it can pop up well away from the road. But I've learned a little bit that they have barbs on them, so they can spread really easily. And so I know that it can be sometimes a little easy to get pessimistic and say, oh, we're going to not be able to stop this. But I learned that we can maybe get rid of it or kill it, but it's preventing it from spreading further, which is really important.
The spread of this complex and its multiple invasive species in the hawkweed group, I've been an invasive plant program manager for all of the national forests in Oregon and Washington. So 25 million acres of national forest land. The hawkweed, the spread of hawkweeds on our national forest lands in Oregon and Washington is one of the most frightening examples of invasive plant spread I have seen in my 15 years of managing that program. They are proving to be insidious in how easily they are spread. Another issue, I think, an area of hawkweed management that we really need to drill down in and start asking people to clean their boots before and after they go hiking, check their mountain bike tires, and check their dog paws and fur. All of those things really are contributing to the spread of hawkweed, in addition to the things we can't control, like wind and water. But we do have some aspects of our behavior that can be modified to help the situation, and I think we need to invest a lot more. Those practices benefit all invasive species management, not just plants and not just hawkweeds, but all kinds of aquatic organisms and even down to insects and fungus that might affect our forests. So good practices are going to be crucial.
Shauna, thank you for sharing that, because I think here in Homer, we are very good at having education and information about Kachemak Bay and those aquatic invasive species that could be a problem because we rely on a healthy ecosystem so much. And I think there is information about some of those land-based invasive species, but it can occasionally get overlooked. It's important to be thinking that we can have an impact, even though it might be a long fight, but to continue to spread that information, that education of what orange hawkweed or yellow hawkweed is, why it's problematic, but also what we can possibly do to continue to prevent it from spreading further around the Kenai Peninsula.
With our massive and very rapid international transport, travel, and trade, this problem is not going away. It's going to require diligence and a change in personal behavior, and to become aware, and for everybody to be on the lookout. If you want to preserve the ecosystems on which you depend, particularly up here in Alaska, the native food from the land is crucially important to folks up here.
That is Shauna Batista from the U.S. Forest Service in conversation with Seth Spencer from the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies in Homer. Next, just a taste of the keynote address. Serving invasive species with a side of awareness, using harvest as a management, education, and outreach tool. Matthew Barnes is a professor of natural resources management at Texas Tech University. He opened the workshop by laying out the case for invasivores.
In recent years, one of the thoughts of how we might be able to deal with species that have been introduced is this concept of maybe, just maybe, we can manage species through harvest. And a couple of examples here. Nutria have been turned into anything from anyone wearing their Nutria boots right now. Lovely throw pillows. And there's a group right now that's catching Nutria and turning them into dog treats as well. This is kudzu, the vine that ate the south. You can turn the blossoms into jelly, and it makes a very delicious jelly. What I've thought about for a while is can we eat our way out of this mess? And this idea really picked up traction in 2010, this idea that maybe we could eat invasive species and put a dent in their population. And there have been a number of publications, right? Save Florida, Eat an Iguana, a whole cookbook dedicated to recipes on how to cook and eat iguanas. The Smart Seafood Guide from Food and Water Watch in 2012 began including some introduced invasive fish populations in their list of how to consume seafood. Around this time as well, a couple of grad students and I developed this website we call invasivore.org. We have sort of learned over the last 8 years or so about the advantages and disadvantages of harvesting and consuming invasive species. And we've learned some things along the way that I'd like to share with you today. Turns out that this may not be a brand new idea. There are, in fact, invasivore type experiments ongoing all around us. Maybe we can tap into that data and learn a little something about whether this is really going to be an effective management strategy or not. So let's start by looking at the existing data. We did go out and do a literature search in scientific literature and did a fairly extensive curation of Google searches as well. And we were looking for examples of invasivity that met two different criteria. The first was we were looking for examples that recommended harvest as a strategy to manage invasive populations. And then the second thing we were looking for was to make sure that the target population was not introduced for the purpose of that harvest or consumption. European birds that have been introduced all over the United States, we didn't include the economic impact of bird watching in this particular analysis because that's what they were put here to do. We were focused primarily on invasive species where new uses and markets are being developed to try and manage. I think invasive species and climate change is of particular interest here in Alaska, where as things are warming up, that is part of the invasive species problem that y'all are facing. But so what we found when we did this review is that harvest as a management recommendation has been increasing dramatically over time. And all kinds of different uses, potential uses of invasive species, ranging from biofuel to food that I'm going to focus on when I start to talk about invasivore, but other things as well, timber and pulp production, for example. And I'll highlight just a couple to start off and show you the things that have sort of whetted my appetite for eating invasive species. One is the introduction of the Asian carp in the Midwest. So these actually were introduced in Arkansas in the 1970s. They were introduced as essentially janitors of catfish farms in Arkansas. They're even though they grow to be a 100-pound fish, they're algae eaters and plankton eaters. And so you can imagine to make 100 pounds of fish, you have to eat a lot of algae and a lot of plankton. And this made them a really good janitor for those catfish farms. But in the 1970s, when there was flooding in Arkansas, these fish managed to get out of those catfish farms and into the Mississippi River. And they started swimming north and are now knocking on the back door of the Great Lakes. And in the Midwest, there has been some interest in harvesting and making the best out of this bad situation. It turns out that there are very large markets globally. These fish are welcome additions to the dinner plate in China and other Asian countries, but there's fairly limited interest in consuming Asian carp in the United States. They've got lots of very small bones, and so they're difficult to clean. And nevertheless, the state of Illinois negotiated and was able to commercially harvest these fish and send them to China at a fairly decent profit. And Illinois is also using these fish and employing commercial fishermen to harvest as part of their management strategy for this fish. And they are serving them at homeless shelters, and they run a campaign called Target Hunger Now, which is, again, making the best out of a bad situation here. Another example that has been more successful with the public has been Noah's Eat Lionfish campaign. And so all throughout the Caribbean, lionfish, which were likely introduced as an aquarium release or a pet shop escape or dump, these lionfish have been introduced up and down the eastern coast and throughout the Caribbean. And Noah has led this campaign. We'll talk a little bit about whether we could consider this as a successful management strategy population-wide. The answer there is probably not. We'd have to be really hungry to make that happen. But at least on local scales, at individual reefs, there's been some anecdotal evidence that lionfish numbers are being reduced in the areas where local seafood shops and restaurants are accepting lionfish on their menu. And for this portion of the talk, I'm going to call a lot on this excellent article by Susan Pascoe and Jason Goldberg. There are proposed benefits and potential backfires to this strategy. Harvesting and eating invasive species may be a way to reduce those populations. As we saw in the case of Asian carp and serving up lionfish in seafood restaurants, there may be opportunities to offset some of those losses caused by invasive species with some profit that comes from selling them. There are potential opportunities to educate the public, and even if we don't make a dent in the current invasion, there are also some potential backfires that I'm sure are already going through everybody's mind, including harvesting and using invasive species may conflict with other messages and control efforts. We can harvest and eat garlic mustard. There's a small population, it would be much easier and simpler and just done if we went out and sprayed a bunch of pesticide or herbicide on that garlic mustard. It's potentially a conflict here. If we are trying to spray while people are out here trying to harvest and consume that, there's potential for some really sticky situations. And then also, maybe even most concerning, by harvesting invasive species and making them desirable in some situations on menus, on dinner plates, there's this potential to create economic incentives that would sort of lead people to want to keep these species around, or to move the species from site to site, or otherwise promote and maintain these invasive populations. And so this is clearly a tricky issue. Mark Twain said, the best way to increase wolves in America, rabbits in Australia, and snakes in India is to pay a bounty on their scalps, and then every patriot goes to raising them. And we have seen this play out in the past. So has anyone ever heard of the cobra effect? This is based on a failed management effort in colonial India where there were too many cobras, and that's not a good thing. And so the British were offering a bounty on cobras. And within the large cities, this appeared to be working really well. Cobras went down. Many people were trading cobras in and getting their bounty, and the incidence of cobras in the big cities went down. The British were horrified to find out when they left the cities that in more rural areas, cobra farms had popped up everywhere, and that the number of cobras in India had actually increased because rural Indians were raising cobras to cash in on that bounty. Think fairly carefully about what some of the social responses to some of these incentives might be, and make sure that you design it in such a way that it will work and accomplish the desired effect. There are also biological considerations, more scientific considerations. If we want to impose harvest as a management strategy, we need to think about the population dynamics of the critters that we're trying to manage. And so things that we need to think about include calculating removal rates and the feasibility of removing these species, understanding the range and preventing reintroduction, predicting overcompensation, and monitoring just the human ability and safety in this process. Garlic mustard requires really high rates of removal. 85 to 95% of that population has to be pulled out of the ground to successfully see reductions in local populations. And with these plants, we've got this added struggle that harvest may leave some parts behind. You may pull the top of the plant out, leave the roots behind, and you might enjoy a garlic mustard meal, but you haven't done anything to manage the population. And so these are the kinds of things we need to think about in terms of the feasibility of this strategy to really, if we really want to use it to reduce populations. Will incentives be effective, as effective, when the densities are really low? When species are really abundant, the catch per unit effort is really high, but as things get rarer, you don't catch them as easily. And so maybe the seafood restaurants that are happy to serve lionfish up here, because it's relatively cheap and easy, the question becomes, will they have the same kind of interest when the population is low and it takes more effort and investment to try and catch these things? Now, another biological consideration that we need to take when thinking about harvest as a management strategy is thinking about the range that we're working on. Nutria have invaded the United States and they have invaded Britain with very different results. When they invaded Britain, there was a very successful 10-year eradication program that was accompanied by a lot of study and scholarly work on nutria populations on the island. They were able to successfully eradicate nutria from the island, and the isolation of that island population really contributed to the ability to get rid of nutria and stay rid of nutria. Compare that to the situation that we have in the lower 48 with introduction of nutria, where the population is very large and widespread, and very difficult to implement some kind of range-wide nutria control program. Even though local success is possible in terms of eradicating nutria, given that the range is very widespread, reintroduction is likely. So this changes the likelihood of success of nutria control in the United States versus in Britain. And then we also need to think about, when we're talking about harvesting invasive species, thinking about the human element, human ability and human safety. Starting with ability, I've given this presentation a couple of times, and every time I fire this slide up, I gotta search for a little while. There's the eye of a python in the water. So if you are a python bounty hunter out in the water of the Everglades and Florida looking for pythons, this particular species may be not a very good target for this harvest strategy because it's so gosh darn hard to find. Then we can add in some of the safety considerations, right? If we're encouraging people to go out and harvest these things, thinking about human ability and safety nonetheless is really important as we start to think about harvest as a management strategy.
That is Matthew Barnes, professor of natural resources management at Texas Tech University. You'll be hearing more from him on next month's Catchamac Science, where we will dig in to invasive edibles in Alaska, invasive signal crayfish in Kodiak, invasive northern pike in Three Mile Lake, dandelions, pheasant, and possibly slime molds. On this episode, you heard from Chris Rainwater from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District Board, Shauna Batista from the U.S. Forest Service, Seth Spencer from the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, and Matthew Barnes from Texas Tech. Special thanks to Gino Graziano, an organizer of the workshop. You'll be hearing from him on knapweed and chokecherry on next month's episode. And we'll talk about herbicides and pesticides. Our theme music is by The Supreme Beings of Leisure, mixed with whale sounds, and Henry Mancini's music and arrangements from The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and It Came from Outer Space. And one more thing. The Cooperative Extension Service has developed an app, the Alaska Weeds ID. The app has an interactive key to identify invasive species by plant feature and easy reporting that captures your location and allows you to submit photos. You can find more information about the conference and the app at alaskainvasives.org. Thanks for listening. Catchamac Science will be back in 4 weeks with more discussions, presentations, and reviews in the lab, in the classroom, and in the field. We share the data from local science by local scientists.